What is at stake in the upcoming referendum on Great Britain's exit from the European Union? Who gains and who loses from the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership and the Trans-Pacific Partnership agreements? What are the main foci in the upcoming Australian elections? And what does the recent homicide of a British Labour MP have in common with the June 12th shootings in an Orlando, Florida nightclub? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we discuss these and related questions with Dr. Binoy Campmark, a distinguished scholar, academic, and geopolitical analyst. On today's program, Brexit debate, Australian elections, and the Orlando shootings, a conversation with Binoy Campmark. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of June 17th, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to the analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available through the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. In the present day and age, critical analysis is indelibly threatened. Most Western intellectuals, by conforming to a broad, politically correct consensus, are tacitly supportive of the capitalist world order. This is crucial because the authority of knowledge and understanding which these establishment intellectuals convey ultimately trickles down to the grassroots of society and shapes the perceptions of the broader public. That authority emanating from those who think on behalf of the ruling elites must be broken as a means to ultimately breaking the ruling elites. The consensus which provides legitimacy to a corrupt economic and social system must be broken. That comes from the English version of the preface to the Spanish edition of the book The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity by Michel Chalcedovsky, appearing under the headline Counter-Propaganda as an Instrument of Peace, Fidel Castro and the Battle of Ideas, The Dangers of Nuclear War, published June 13th. The Ross Ward case, which exploded across the Australian university sector in May, suggested the extent university managerialism will go to remove an academic for something as simple as a Facebook posting in a private capacity. There was nothing suggestive in what was posted by Ward, an irate comment fuming at the Australian flag as racist. We are not to know at this stage if her initial suspension was cover for naked vengeance, a form of assassination by means of censorship. The letter from the university sent to Ward claimed that she had been suspended from work for, quote, engaging in misconduct, unquote. In all likelihood, it was the sense that Ward was attracting undue attention and being harassed by such Murdoch outlets as The Australian for her Marxist and pro-LGBTI stance. That comes from the article, Clipping Academic Freedom in Australia, The Use of Social Media to Express Opinions, by Dr. Binoy Campmark, posted June 14th. Even though there was a president of African descent elected twice to the White House, fundamentally there has been no change in the power structure and economic relations of production within U.S. capitalist society. Consequently, a revolutionary movement encompassing various organizational expressions is necessary to address the current crisis. The limitations of spontaneous demonstrations and rebellions has been illustrated since 2013 when public sentiment against the killings of Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Eric Gardner, Freddie Gray, Sandra Bland, and others sparked mass protests and unrest. Nonetheless, obviously absent from the present political landscape are organizations such as SNCC and the BPP, which places people on the ground in communities and on the campuses to mobilize and agitate for revolutionary change. This is the major challenge of this period, and it can only be addressed by the newer generation drawing upon the best in the social traditions among the oppressed and the working class. That comes from the article, 50th Anniversary of the Black Power Slogan and Its Significance, by Abayomi Azikiwe, posted June 14th. Trump expects a wholesale incorporation of the Sanders support machine into the Clinton campaign. In this scenario, marginalized white workers and downwardly mobile middle-class voters will confront the real face of Wall Street's darling warmonger, Madame Clinton, and be less likely to reject Trump's opportunism with the right-wing Congressional Business Alliance. Any working-class opposition to his embrace of the neoliberal Congressional Republicans will be deflected by revelations of Clinton's big business dealings and covert operations with foreign leaders. If pursued by the FBI, Clinton's blatant violation of federal security regulations, her private and illegal system of communication and liaison with foreign officials while Secretary of State could blow up her campaign and hand the presidency to Donald Trump. Trump has gained working-class voter support in West Virginia, Ohio, and many other Rust Belt states because of Clinton's free trade and anti-working-class history, which has shattered any residual illusions about the Democratic Party. That comes from the article, Trump's Turn to the Neoliberal Republican Elite. Only Clinton Can Save Trump's Electoral Victory, by Professor James Petras, posted June 15th. History tells us about the brief appearances of past progressive movements that promised to benefit the common man, like Fighting Bob, La Follette's Progressive Party era, Eugene Debs's Persecuted Socialist Party, FDR's New Deal era, the anti-war liberal efforts of JFK, RFK, and MLK, Eugene McCarthy, Paul Wellstone's People's Campaign, Ralph Nader's Green Party candidacy, Occupy Wall Street's efforts, the disappearing Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, and most importantly, all those millions of eager, progressive-minded, college-age Bernie supporters who so clearly see the dire need for a true political revolution. The Democratic Party is shooting itself in the foot by rejecting the idealism of America's energetic progressive youth. Those clear-headed American youth know that there must be a sea change in American politics and economics before they and their planet are disappeared down the rat hole of perpetual war, the hopelessness of perpetual predatory educational loan repayments, unstoppable environmental degradation and enslavement by the many amoral, entrenched elites who are refusing to give them a break or a hand up because such merciful actions might endanger their personal investment portfolios. Bernie Sanders' campaign for the heart and soul of America may or may not be over, but there is information regarding the Democratic Party's voter suppression and election fraud that has not been reported on. Inquiring minds need to know about it. That comes from the article, Why Many Bernie Sanders Supporters Will Soon Be Abandoning the Democratic Party and Why Their Superdelegates Will Someday Regret Sabotaging His Candidacy, by Dr. Gary G. Kroles, posted June 15th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Dr. Binoy Campmark is a senior lecturer in the School of Global Urban and Social Studies, teaching within the Bachelor of Social Science program on legal and dispute studies at RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia. He was a Commonwealth Scholar at Selwyn College in Cambridge, and he often comments as an expert on international and national security, terrorism, the war on terror, and politics, and is a frequent contributor to the Global Research site. He joined us recently from London, England. Thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Campmark.
It's an absolute pleasure being with you.
Now, I understand you're covering the Brexit debate. So I'm just wondering if you could kind of give us a bit of an overview of what you're seeing in the British media, in the streets. How are people confronting this big referendum?
Well, I think one of the things very striking about the flavor of the days, the last few days at least, has been the fact that the Vote Leave campaign, so that's the campaign headed up by the rather colorful and bumbling politician Boris Johnson, former Mayor of London, and a few notable Conservative figures like Michael Gove. It seems that initially a marginal movement, a movement to leave the EU, for Britain to leave the EU, has gained considerable traction, and that is frightening those who are going for the votes for the Stay campaign. And the underestimation of their Stay campaign, if you like, for those who want Britain to remain in the EU, has been considerable. And it's a topic that may well come back to haunt them, but this particular assumption that staying in the EU is just a logical and incontestable idea is something that is coming back to haunt them.
I understand that. I mean, it's both the Labour and both the Conservatives and the Labour parties are pushing for staying in the EU.
Yes, well, there are a couple of things to keep in mind here. Each of the parties has their Eurosceptics. It's important to realize that there are only one party, I suppose, is openly for leaving the EU, and that is the UK Independence Party, which is shortened to UKIP, led by Nigel Farage. But within both Labour, and it's important to note, for example, that its current leader, Jeremy Corbyn, has expressed a certain ambivalence about Europe and has been a past critic of the EU and the European institutions. So even though Labour, generally speaking, has a pro-stay campaign, there is also an underlying issue that particular campaign has not been as strong as it might otherwise be, for the simple reason that there are closet Eurosceptics, if you like, within the Labour Party. But the Conservative Party, more broadly speaking, is very much divided on this. You've got a very strong leave sentiment, which individuals such as Boris Johnson, who I mentioned before. But then you've got the Prime Minister of Britain, David Cameron, and you've got the Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne, who have come up with various scenarios to, if you like, to frighten the populace into the idea that if they do leave, there will be all hell break loose, economically speaking, and also in a security context. So those are more or less how the sides line up at the moment.
Well, I wonder if you could talk about this trending lately towards leaving, and like, has there been any specific dynamics within Britain that has brought people to the point where they said enough is enough?
I think there are a few aspects to that question that need to be addressed, and one of them is a regional issue. The regional issue in Britain, and this I think is coming out very strongly, it's the vast gulf that exists between a very large metropolitan center such as London, which is the central heart and being, if you like, when it comes to Britain, and deemed something of a behemoth, something of a monster by the rest of Britain for its use and reliance in resources, but also what it produces. But those outside London have a different view on a lot of these things. And what has happened in terms of the debates recently is that those outside London are starting to express the views, some of them on the more cynical side about the EU, and considering the prospects about what it would be like to be outside the European Union. So, for example, the farmers, a good dominant lobby of farmers have suggested that it might be actually better to look at other markets. It might be better to move outside the constraints and the paperwork by the EU. Now, I think it's an erroneous assessment, because the British agrarian sector receives a considerable amount of money from the EU and considerable amount of subsidy, but that's beside the point. Image is everything in this debate. And they, being, of course, in the agrarian sector, being outside London, have a different view, and this is one way of poking, if you like, the beast that is London. So that's one aspect, the different views, regionally speaking, to that of the metropolis itself. And London is the sheer scale of London cannot be exaggerated in this regard. And the other thing, too, is the campaign, the Leave campaign, actually, has been very aggressive, and it's been very aggressive on a daily basis. It cannot be faulted, actually. Their campaign has been remarkably aggressive in terms of trying to get their message across. The pamphlets that have been bombarding British households, I've seen a couple of the pamphlets as well. These range from the hysterical, talking about, for example, the entrance into the EU of other countries. So, for example, Turkey. Now, the chances of Turkey entering the EU within the next 30 years is highly questionable. The same with Serbia, the same with countries like Montenegro. But this is all advertised as dangerous because, of course, the assumption is being made that all these countries, when they join, will then provide a vast pool of potential immigrants and individuals who, because of the principle of mobility and free movement that the EU endorses, these people will be then allowed to enter Britain. And this is one of the arguments being made, the failure to control borders, the loss in control, if you like, of sovereignty in this regard. So that aspect of it has been pushed home very, you know, the British bulldog aspect, the idea of John Bull being irate at not being able to control the borders. And that's something that's seemingly coming through in a very powerful way. Patriotic Britain, if you like, and the idea of control.
Mm-hmm. It kind of reminds me, in a way, of the what we have with these corporate trade deals. In North America, we have NAFTA, and there have been concerns about the erasing of national sovereignty there. At least that's the way the argument has largely been framed. But, I mean, it does occur to me that the EU was established in the glory days of neoliberalism. And I'm wondering if you could talk about that idea of the, who benefits or what the primary driver of the creation of the EU in the first place is essentially a creature of, a transnational transnational corporate interest instrument.
Well, you make a very interesting point in the context of the origins of what has become the EU. And, of course, the original mechanism is known as the European Common Market, and then the community, the European Economic Community, and so forth. So in all these manifestations, it was unquestionable that there was a large economic dimension to it, although the difference being from NAFTA, for example, and that's a very big difference either from NAFTA or, for that matter, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, of course, that's in its final questionable stages of implementation now. They're different because the visions of the political dimension are slightly different in that the European project was also based on a security project. The idea behind the European Economic Community and the idea behind the genesis, if you like, of what has become the EU was also designed to maintain peace, and to a very large extent it has succeeded in that. It has actually maintained the status quo. Countries in Europe who have been for centuries warring against each other have actually put down their arms, laid down their arms, and so on. Now, of course, there's several dimensions to this as to why and the implications of that. But it's important to note that, and this is something that simply has not been emphasized enough, that the EU has, by and large, actually been a peacekeeping mechanism of some force. Now, of course, the other side of it is that it got very caught up, as you suggested, by the neoliberal project. It got hijacked somewhat along the way by the financing and the market project. So rather than looking at it from a social democratic perspective as a welfare model, the EU has moved into, and it never was really transparent in terms of its institutions. So what has happened is that the EU has moved into very much an argument about trade and about lifestyle and about movement and about labor. It's not really an argument about of social justice per se, and this is something that has been lost. And it's something that, and this is what is interesting in terms of the Leave campaign, many of those individuals who are opposing it would actually be very happy with other aspects of trade deals that offer, for example, access to British goods and offer low tariffs. They would be happy with that. What they're not happy about is, by and large, seemingly, the idea that they're being told what to do to a large extent by institutions in Brussels. So, for example, be it the Commission or be it, for example, the Court in Strasbourg, the European Courts of Human Rights and Justice, these particular entities are always frowned upon by the Eurosceptics because they, the critics feel that they are trampling upon British sovereignty and that the Brits know best. But of course, this ignores the very obvious point that institutions such as the European Court of Justice are based very much on legal principles that have a very deep resonance and ring very strongly with British law, the rights of the Magna Carta and common law and so on. So it's a bit of a complex situation we find ourselves in, individuals who want to leave the EU, but are still, by and large, individuals who would like to endorse free trade. But they don't want to endorse a model where the institutions themselves have become such that they're beyond scrutiny or that there is a higher power above the power of Britain itself, you know, the sovereign power that is located in other institutions.
Hmm. Well, you mentioned Jeremy Corbyn a little while ago, and of course we ran our interview with about Jeremy Corbyn last week, and I wanted to see if you could probe a little bit to where that ambiguity you spoke of is coming from. Like what is the appeal for him to this staying in the EU, and what is the what's behind his sort of lackluster pom-pom waving, as it were?
Well, I do think that he's done so largely because his wings have been clipped in this debate. It's not one of those that he's comfortable with. He would be far more comfortable, and one just has to look at his record and speeches prior to him becoming leader and his record as a member and his record as an activist, that he is very skeptical about the centralizing agenda of the European Union and the general centralizing nature of European institutions. He is a skeptic of that, and he does believe that Britain should have greater freedom and things. But the difference, I suppose, with Jeremy Corbyn is that he does have his argument is more as a critic of the neoliberal project. His argument is a bit like, for example, the argument that is made by the former Greek finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, who actually did make the argument that the European project, of course, has become very much a market project rather than a social justice or welfare project. So that's Jeremy Corbyn's position on that sort of thing. He's very skeptical from that perspective. But because he's got such in a situation where most of his MPs, and by far the vast majority, in fact, off the top of my head, there are very few that would probably certainly associate themselves with the Leave campaign. He himself is the vocal figure, or has been historically the vocal figure, very much critical of the EU. So he's in a situation where virtually everybody in his party, at least the visible face of his party, are against, or for rather staying, very much against leaving, whereas he has been critical. So that would explain why there was a certain incoherence and a lackluster, as you say, effort on his part regarding this campaign.
So bottom line then, what is at stake in this referendum? Next week, we're going to know, it could go one way or the other. What will it mean for Great Britain and for the rest of the EU if there is, in fact, a Brexit?
Well, yes, this is a fascinating point. The first thing is the immediacy of the result, irrespective of what happens with the referendum. Of course, if the referendum favors the Stay campaign, then David Cameron will regard his job, at least in that sense, as done, and then he will then go forth and say that the British people have said stay, but that his agenda has been to renegotiate Britain's links with the EU and use the campaign essentially, or use the outcome of the referendum as a means to do that. But of course, I would suggest that he probably did not calculate that the Leave campaign would be so powerful, which has put him in an awkward position. So if the leavers, if the Brexiteers actually get what they want, they get the outcome they want, it puts Cameron's government in a situation where it could actually collapse. So that's one of the immediate things. So if he does not abide by it, and even if he does abide by it, that's the great problem. It may actually mean that the government may fall. This is one of the scenarios anyway. But the other situation that's also significant about it is whether Cameron and the cabinet actually acknowledge, if you like, the legitimacy of the vote. And this is where it becomes a bit treacherous, because other governments in the European Union have tried to manufacture consent. They've tried to they have a particular referendum on an aspect of the EU. It might be adopting the common currency. It might be an aspect of constitutional change and so on. And then what they've done is they've had a negative vote, but then they then try to run a new referendum with slightly adjusted parameters in order to get the result they want, or they just ignore it and try to pass it through Parliament and so on. So the question will be whether there is a situation where David Cameron will try to manufacture an escape out of this so that he does not have to abide by the referendum. You have to remember, it's a non-binding referendum. It's not a situation where they have to follow it, but of course not doing so will endanger his political existence. And so that'll be the big problem there. And in terms of other things, they will have to be seen in terms of a constitutional problem. Britain is very much linked to the European institutions, and the question then will become, of course, you know, what will happen to British products, what will happen to British security, what will happen to the status of Britain, and what will happen, of course, with other parts of Britain. For example, the Scottish National Party will express see this as an opportunity to capitalize upon, too, to seek independence from Britain itself, to further their campaign, which was not successful when they had a referendum, of course, in Scotland regarding that. So the series of considerations, the permutations that arise out of this are considerable, are vast, and very interesting, to say the least, but not necessarily, they don't necessarily augur well for stability, but then again, it may also be an exaggeration, too.
And I guess speaking of stability, there's a major trade deal underway between the U.S. and the EU. Would a Brexit complicate those negotiations?
Well, yes, absolutely. The situation there is that since Britain advertises it through the corridor of London, advertises itself as a hub of financial services, and advertises itself as a particularly important, if you like, parking space for banking and for finance. Of course, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which is currently being negotiated, is a key aspect of that and reflects that very much. So the idea there is that if Britain leaves, it may well add another dimension, another complication to it. It doesn't necessarily have to, of course, sink the negotiations, even though I think to a large extent they deserve to be sunk, quite frankly, given the contents from what has been made available, and it's very scant, as you know, what's been made available for the TTIP. But that aside, even if Britain does leave, I do not see them being excluded from the talks for the simple reason that there will be, the US will regard them as a very important aspect, the London market, the city, as it were, of London is a very important aspect in terms of their financial arrangements. Let's not forget the influence that London banks, or banks based in London, had, rather, to put it more accurately, on the various crises we've had, including the great financial crisis, where subprime mortgages as a mechanism began first as an entity in the London markets, you know, as a means to develop revenue. And so this was then exported back to the US after Clinton then, of course, eased off on restrictions on banks. So the British legacy in this will be a strong one, and I do not think that they'll be excluded from it, irrespective of how the vote goes.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Well, I guess now that we've sort of segued into the topic of the trade deals, and particularly the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, TTIP, I know that there have been about 248 pages of that document had been leaked thanks to Greenpeace Netherlands. And I'm wondering if you have a chance to examine those leaks and if what stands out about them for you.
Well, I have had a chance to look at some of those, some of the material, and it's very similar in terms of the problems it raises to that has been put forth in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, which is the counterweight, of course, in the Asia-Pacific. And the problems are, for example, labor rights. The problems are as to what will happen in the context of an agreement in terms of how this works, because, of course, when you have such a market mechanism introduced, certain rights go by the wayside. What's the oversight, for example, regarding labor rights in the EU as opposed to then with the U.S. in terms of the deals made? There are issues of copyright, certainly. The same problems, intellectual property matters that were found in the negotiations in the TPP. And there are issues, of course, with environmental standards and food and health and safety, because the reality of it is that in the EU there are very stringent controls, for example, on labeling and stringent controls about describing in depth what the nature of the content of the product is. There are restrictions, for example, certainly there are strict restrictions on genetically modified food products and so forth, and GMOs and all of that. So this deal, the nature of the Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership is meant to be like a kind of a bulldozing effect that effectively is meant to open up the EU market, which is a huge market, one of the largest on the planet, in fact, one of the largest blocks on the planet, which is something the United States, of course, wants access to. Mm. So the problems with all of that are the problems we saw with the TPP, the imposition of a Washington-driven model, if you like, of the economy in its, call it free market, but of course it's not a free market deal. It is a controlled economic deal with vested interests to pursue the agenda of certain corporate lobbies, and this is exactly what the TTIP also does. And so what has been leaked is a demonstration of a lot of those concerns, you know, be they environmental protections or lack of, be they the reduction of protections when it comes to food and health safety. All these things are very significant when it comes to the negotiation of that deal.
Could you give us a bit of a description of the makeup of the resistance and which countries they're located? I mean, are we talking principally, is it basically the old anti-globalization so-called movements just latching on to one? Or?
Yes, no, certainly. I think in terms of the issues there is the traditional, and this is the thing that's very important to realize, the anti-globalization movement has sort of suffered in the aftermath of the September 11th, 2001 attacks in the United States, and it just seems swallowed up essentially by the moment and the order of the day. But what the TPP debates, and then the equivalent being discussed in the European context, what this has shown is that there is a new and energetic resistance that has come through in the context of those who have tried to, and to a certain extent, I have to admit, have been somewhat successful in pressuring their governments to make changes or certainly make provisions and safeguards in terms of it. If you look at the drafts of the TPP, for example, before it made its final form to be implemented, you will find actually that certain changes were made on pressure by various activist groups across, be they related to environment, be they related to the Electronic Frontiers Foundation, for example, and so on. But in this particular case, there is another dimension, and that is, of course, that certain countries have made it very clear that certain areas are non-negotiable. So the French Prime Minister, for example, President François Hollande has made it very clear that certain aspects are simply not negotiable when it comes to rights of French citizens in terms of the economy and so on. And he's made it very clear that if these things are not abided by, he will have no interest in signing the deal. So it's important to note that there is also certain states are showing their traditional social democratic colors, if you like, in terms of how such an agreement will affect the medical sector in terms of prices, the notion of healthcare, for example, because you have to remember a very important aspect of this debate also will be what the U.S. pharmaceutical giants will hope to get out of it. And one of those, of course, is the issue of providing medical services and products. And the U.S. market system is very sympathetic to U.S. pharmaceutical giants, and the result of that will be, of course, higher prices for drugs. And so this is something that is simply, but some European leaders have said, it's a non-negotiable thing.
And you know, you're talking about the resemblances with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and I know here in Canada, the Trudeau government is calling for an end to its consultation process with Canadians on the TPP. So I'm kind of curious to know if there's maybe updated information about what's in the TPP and the state of the negotiations there.
Well, yes, and certainly the thing now, of course, is that at some point the states, all the 12 countries involved, are going to be trying to implement some aspect or the creature that is the TPP. And so the reality of it is that the so-called final form is never going to be, of course, a total final form, because it's going to be implemented in various aspects and shades and so on in each of the countries concerning the deal, and each country will do so slightly differently. In some cases, maybe even more dramatically so. So, for example, there are provisions that allow countries to catch up, five-year provisions, for example, for Vietnam in terms of its certain industries and so forth, in terms of its standards of labor and so on and so forth. So, obviously, the unevenness of this, too, means that the implementation is going to be different, and the material in terms of how it's interpreted is going to be different. So we're talking about a whole range of factors to be considered in terms of how this particular agreement is going to be brought to bear in terms of the practical nature of it.
I've heard the TPP and the TTIP being discussed in a geostrategic capacity insofar as TPP is marginalizing China, and TTIP is marginalizing Russia economically. Can you speak to that at all?
Yes, well, I think if you look at the patterning and the nature of the individual states involved in it, there's no question that if you are going to be in a situation where you're losing control over dictating the rules, and that's not even my expression, that actually comes from President Barack Obama himself, who's made it very clear that the United States, with its allies, wants to be in a position to dictate the rules of trade. They want to dictate the financial rules of the globe. So for that to happen, of course, this particular, the TPP, is very much a poke and a disdainful look across towards the Chinese market, which has proven to be formidable and very hard in terms of control relative to U.S. interests. And so the TPP is a block that, and this is where you get the free trade nonsense that's being peddled, and that is, it's very obvious that this is not a free trade agreement. It's rather an economic block designed to make deals within the block that is then designed to buffer against such powers as China and so forth. And the same thing in the context of, when we're talking about the TTIP, in that particular situation, it's very obvious that that particular agreement is also being sold as a way of combating, say, Russia and to a certain extent even isolating it, which is always a dangerous thing to do. And more should be done, if anything, to incorporate Russia into economic arrangements rather than rejecting it, because history does not augur well when countries such as Russia are ignored or completely sidelined in the context of global economy. So that is, again, another big problem that we're witnessing.
Now, Binoy Kantmark, I'd like to touch on another subject with you, and that would be the Australian elections. I think Australians are going to the polls on July 2nd. I was wondering if you could maybe help us understand what some of the major dynamics are in that election. I mean, like, what instigated this particular election, just for starters?
Well, to a large extent, you have to understand that the Australian election is a curious beast, because it's based on this particular one is Australians are witnessing one of the longest election campaigns in living memory, if not history, and that is so many weeks are being undertaken to deal with the poll before the Australians actually vote and start. They've already started to pre-poll, as they call it, so they can actually vote before the actual formal poll takes place, and so it already opened, in fact, a few days ago. But in terms of the campaign, it's been long, it's been dreary, and it's been very unsatisfactory. And so why it was triggered was because the Prime Minister, and it's called a double dissolution election, and what that means is that it's designed to deal with a Senate that's being obstructionist. So Australia has a bicameral system. In other words, it's got an upper chamber like a Senate, similar to the House of Congress, similar to the congressional houses and so forth. And it has a Senate House and it has a House of Representatives. Now, the House of Representatives is where the Prime Minister comes from. So that's where government is. And then the upper house is the scrutineer, if you like, of the political process and will make amendments and suggest deals, and so the government of the day has to win favor with the senators to pass various deals. Now, there were several aspects of the Turnbull government that were beyond compromise. They refused to compromise. That's always a very unhealthy thing, but that's the reality of politics, also in Australian politics. So he decided then he threatened that he would go to an election, and this would be a double dissolution election, and that's what he did. And so the result is that Australians have to vote over essentially very lackluster, ordinary policies that have always the same fairly meaningless words, which is growth, more growth, and jobs, of course. So these are the things that both major parties are trying to push forth. And there is a certain dreary materialism to Australian elections that's very striking. A lot of discussion about insurance, about superannuation, which is a form of a pension that is backed essentially by both the employer and the employee, and a range of other factors that are very much on the material side.
Can you speak to the political atmosphere that was generated under Mr. Turnbull's predecessor, Tony Abbott? What is his shadow lurking over this election in any capacity?
Well, yes, the shadow is very much there, because Australian politics in the last 6-7 years has been plagued by a revolving door policy when it comes to leaders. And so it's something that I've remarked upon before, that every time I leave Australia for a stint and I go back, there's a new leader in power. And that's not because of an election. It's because the particular leader of the party has been overthrown. And this is one of the oddities of the Westminster system as well, that the Prime Minister can actually be deposed by the party. It's, of course, a deeply anti-democratic aspect of the system, but that is very much in place. And Australia has now seen three prime ministers subject to fate. So two Labour prime ministers suffered that, and Tony Abbott, Malcolm Turnbull's predecessor, also suffered that fate, where he was knifed essentially by the party that put him there to begin with. He was considered a bit too cavalier, a bit too, as it were, macho for the position, and having made a series of decisions that were very much beyond consultation. So that's been the problem in Australian politics now for 7 years or so, coming now to 8 years, that we have a situation where there is a revolving door in action, and that's very problematic for stability. Even though Australia is a very stable country, it seems that it doesn't have a very stable office of prime minister.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't voting in Australian elections mandatory?
Yes, it is. Australia is one of the countries of the world that actually makes voting mandatory. That's exactly right. So not only mandatory, there's another interesting aspect of it, is that it also makes voting on the actual ballot paper quite strict. So, for example, you have to, for the House of Representatives, you have to, not just is it a compulsory thing to vote, you have to fill in every box because of the preferential system of voting that Australia has.
Are we getting a more accurate expression of the will of the people as compared to areas like Canada or United States where voting is not mandatory?
Well, that's always been the argument in Australia, that Australia is considered, I wouldn't say unique, but considered certainly one of the exceptional countries in terms that you can't use the argument of a disenfranchised vote because individuals, you can't, for example, say that it's a not a legitimate vote because 40% of the populace stayed at home. That never happens in Australia. You always get, of course, the turnout will always be in the percentage points in the 90s and so, and so on and so forth. But having said that, in my personal experience of it, having seen Australian elections over the years and seeing how the Australian electorate behaves in these circumstances, it's posed a very interesting dilemma. I'm not convinced that making people vote necessarily means they're more informed. It doesn't mean to say that because you're made to turn up and vote, that you're necessarily more engaged with the political process and less alienated from the politicians from the capital in Canberra. I'm simply not convinced by that argument. And so even though there is a physical dimension and a logistical dimension to having someone vote, and the claim can then be made that this is meant to show will of the people, it's true enough, it shows a certain will of the people, but then, I just think in a more severe form of those elections that will be held in police states or authoritarian regimes where 95% of the vote people would turn up and so on, and that did not necessarily mean that the people were informed per se, they simply did what they were told. And so in Australia there is an element of that that comes into the political process.
And I'm wondering about, irrespective of the motivations of the respective parties of Mr. Turnbull, I'm wondering what you see the ballot box question being for the people of Australia. What's on their minds, and what is likely to determine their vote, and to what extent is that? Are those currents going to be exploited by the parties?
Well, yes. Well, again, we're back to this issue in Australia about the. It's not that they're trivial concerns, but there's not a spiritual or philosophical dimension to the voting in Australia. There's not a grand idea that people go to vote for. On the contrary, it's very small ideas. But it's very important to note that it's essentially that of the bookkeeping accounting mentality. People go and vote. People who go and vote are concerned about mortgages. They're concerned about levels of repayment. They're concerned about insurance. They're concerned about what's in the kitty when they get older. It's a very material-based aspect. And then, of course, depending on previous elections, the issue of security may come into play, although foreign affairs plays a very small part in Australian elections, with the possible exception in terms of the impacts, of course, of terrorist attacks and how these have been manipulated in the Australian context. There is a general sense that the issues at Australian elections are not going to be the vast canvas issues of life, and they essentially involve matters, as I said, the material things of life. And if these things are under threat, or these things are, if the government can do something more for the particular citizen, you just have to look at the political slogans and advertising. It's about jobs, it's about the economy, and it's about that word which has been co-opted by Malcolm Turnbull, the obsession with innovation. So innovation is the big thing. So all of these things are the sorts of things that are essentially on the rather uninspiring table of Australian electoral options.
I'm wondering if the lengthy campaign period in Australia is that likely going to backfire, or is that going to help the incumbents? Well, what are you thinking about that?
Well, that's a very valid question in the context of strategy and political strategy. In this particular instance, it seems that Prime Minister Turnbull is very confident that he will maintain power. But what is happening, seemingly, and this is another factor that has to be factored into it as well, is that the opposition leader has been gaining. And in fact, it seems to be a very close poll. It seems, in terms of the performance of both parties, the polling data that's coming out shows both parties neck and neck, both the opposition and the incumbent. Even though the prime minister is considerably ahead of the opposition leader, but as I pointed out to you before, it's a Westminster system, and so obviously the prime minister is not elected separately by the people, and so that doesn't matter. In this case, it's the party that's elected and the party individuals who are elected. So in that situation, the lengthiness of this particular election has meant that there is room to stumble. And Turnbull, it's for Turnbull to lose, really, this particular election. And the Labour Party, under the lead of Bill Shorten, has made the point that they are the underdogs and they will go in to the election as underdogs. But the other thing that I am also noticing, and it's a very important point, is that there is the role of the independents and other smaller parties. It could well be that this could be another hung parliament. If Labour does well enough to eliminate the majority of the government, and irrespective of who then ends up in power, we may see a situation where they have to do the unthinkable in Australian politics, which is actually either form coalitions with other parties or make compromises with other parties across the aisle. And that is something that the tribal nature of Australian politics doesn't permit.
What are some of the thoughts that have come to your mind in the wake of the Omar Mateen and shooting, to death dozens in a gay nightclub? What is the big picture perspective that you're bringing to this?
Yes, well, there are a couple of things to consider here, and one is that that rather clumsy confection which has been used in security studies over the last few years, and that is the lone wolf phenomenon in terms of terrorism. But I simply am never convinced enough by the idea of the lone wolf, for the simple reason that an individual can be motivated by a range of things and so forth. And it's important to note that the gun culture in the United States, when it's combined with an individual who can still have the means of possessing such weapons, can still have the means of having access to such weapons, and yet may not necessarily be medically fit, in a sense, to have such weapons, is a very pronounceable nature. It's a very important thing to keep in mind. And this particular individual, Mamatin, seems to have been a fabulist. He seemed to have a very inventive sense about what he had done. He expressed support for the Boston bombers, the Marathon bombers. He expressed support for al-Nusra. He expressed support for Islamic State. But it has to be understood that there is nothing coherent about this. And in a sense, what tends to happen when an attack like this takes place is that there will always be those standing by to impose a picture of the world upon why these attacks take place. So obviously, the presumptive Republican nominee, Donald Trump, did the inevitable, which was to proclaim that he was right all along and that Islamic individual followers of Islam should be prevented from coming to the United States, and that essentially the Muslim community in the U.S. was complicit in some way by not preventing it. And then the other side of it, and you've seen this too in comments made by various Republican figures, was that Obama could have prevented it and was responsible for it. So there's no coherence at all in any of these arguments in terms of causation. The reality of it is seemingly being that this particular man was a deeply troubled individual with a history of violence, had access to particular weapons, and as happens in the United States, in contrast to other countries, if people have deep psychological issues or grievances, they might go and see a counselor or might go through a mediation session and so on. In the United States, the mediation session takes the form of an assault rifle and resolving a grievance through a massacre. This seems to happen time and time and again. The resolution of disputes takes place via the barrel of the gun. That seems to be a scenario that happens all too frequently. But then, of course, the other aspect, the terrorist aspect, is simply not convincing to me. A person can articulate any particular view in terms of why they're killing people, but ultimately it wasn't a political, ideological, religious exercise. It was the exercise of a very sick man who was determined to make an impact on history. And that, sadly, is the the dimension I see happening, and unfortunately there will be people always on the sidelines capitalizing on such a position.
Mm-hmm. And I understand you have as of this recording, an unpublished article that's going to be coming out on Global Research soon. Is there anything you could maybe give us a bit of a lead to what you're going to be discussing in that article?
Yes, well, what I'm going to be dealing with or have dealt with in that particular piece is the comparison of this situation with other instances. Now, your listeners may be aware of this, that even though it, in terms of sheer scale, it's dwarfed by what happened in Orlando, but an MP in Yorkshire, a British Labour MP in Yorkshire in Britain, was shot and stabbed to death, well, just yesterday, as a matter of fact. So we've got a situation here where a person with a similar, if you like, blueprint, mentally speaking, who had no sense of the political dimension of his life, very little coherence about it, expressed considerable violence, attacked an MP, the first British MP, serving MP, to be killed since 1990. And in so killing her, he seemed to have made the seemed to be shouting, comments to the effect of Britain first and so on. So what was chilling about it, of course, was that it seemed to suggest a right-wing association and so on, even though no right-wing organization in Britain has claimed responsibility. So you've got that situation. You've got the situation in Orlando. And then I was reminded as well about the incidents in December 15th, 2014, when an individual who was very similar to the Orlando gunman, very similar in disposition, in terms of his fantasy, in terms of his narcissism, he took hold of hostages at the Lindt Cafe shop in Sydney and was subsequently killed along with two others in the police raid that followed. And Manharon Monis was his name, and he had a very similar disposition because he confected his life story. He suggested that he was involved with several intelligence agencies. He embraced one form of Shia Islam one day and abandoned it in favor of a Sunni form of Islam the next. And again, attempts were made to try to impose some systematic interpretation on what he was doing, but no systematic interpretation is ever possible, for the simple reason that such individuals will always act that way, and their acts will be, of course, appropriated and used by other forces for their own aims. And Islamic State similarly claimed responsibility for Omar Mateen's case and also with Manharon Monis. But the reality of it is that there is no evidence of direct involvement with ISIS at all, with either case. No evidence of communications, no evidence of this. It's just ISIS or Islamic State taking advantage of a situation where they felt they could have done, they couldn't have done it better, so to speak. And so this is this kind of situation that we're seeing emerging in these particular events which I was covering in the piece.
Okay. Well, Binoy Kantmark, you've been very generous with your time, and I really want to thank you for sharing your thoughts with us on the current dynamics in the world scene. So thank you very much for joining us.
And Michael, it's always a pleasure. Anytime. Thank you.
Okay. We've been speaking with Binoy Kantmark. He was a Cambridge scholar at Selwyn College in Cambridge and lectures at RMIT University in Melbourne. And he's also a frequent contributor to the Global Research website. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.